good afternoon. So, last time, we talked a bit more about distributed transactions. We went over why sort of our naive solution, wouldn't work in more detail. We saw that, it was even inconsistent in the sense that, we could kind of observe that some change that was supposed to take place on multiple machines was happening, rather than seeing your values just before or after. And we have this idea called two-phase commit that would solve that problem and also the problem of sort of operations being half done if we had a failure. And two-phase commit, we had our two phases. We had this preparing phase where we see if everyone can do it, and then we had this finishing phase where normally we'd commit the operation, have everyone actually do it. And to handle failures, we'd follow the pattern we saw with redo logging. If we log our intended actions before doing it, meaning that on a failure, when we come back up and can figure out what's going on from the log, we say, oh, let's redo that thing we intended on doing, just in case. We talked a bit about mapping that protocol to a state machine. And sort of in that design, sort of what we record in the log is our current state. We record that before we actually do the actions associated with that state. On a failure, we come back up, we look at our log, we go back to that state by doing whatever action got us into the state. And the current state would tell us what we do when we get messages from other machines. And using this, it's also going to let us sort of systematically think about, oh, how do I handle any particular case? Am I missing some case? We're going to see ways to do that. So questions before we talk about that a little more? Other things we covered last time? Yes. Quiz by the quiz. Okay. Question four on the quiz. So let's pull up quiz. So question four is here. Okay. So question four on the quiz says we have a scenario where we have a transaction involving two worker machines and a coordinator. The coordinator fails in the middle of the transaction, and it fails in such a way that we can't actually figure out if the transaction is going to commit or not. Before the coordinator recovers, the question is, what else can we do? And the answer is, we can do any operation which doesn't conflict with the pending transaction. And in our scenario, we have orders and items and customers, and if we think of most of the operations we do, most of them are probably not going to involve the exact same items, or even if they do, it's probably not in a way which it's going to matter exactly what happens to the other items, the order that's pending. So probably we can do a whole bunch of other transactions, even involving the same machine, as long as we don't need to use the same coordinator machine that's still down. That's how we got A and B. A and B are both cases where we're not using the same machines, we're not using the same coordinator that's down, and we have lots of transactions we can do that aren't going to conflict. Yes, there are some which would, but most of the transactions we'd want to do aren't going to conflict. There shouldn't be a problem. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, but let's say there's one item left in A1, and the next coordinator that's after the coordinator that's currently
So the question is, what happens in scenario B if we're working on the exact same item, not just another item that happens to have its information stored in the same machine, and we don't know whether we'd run out? In that case, we can't do the new tell you what should happen for the new transaction. We can't tell whether it should say, yes, there's an item there, yes, that works, or no, it doesn't. And in that case, we're not going to give a useful answer. Before the coordinator recovers. But yeah, the point of this is that we're asking, it says can complete transactions, not can complete every single transaction we can think of. And if we think of most transactions, probably that we're not going to have that problem. And there's certainly many transactions we can make up which we could do. Does that answer your question? Other questions? People look confused. I guess I should also, for completeness, talk about C. We can't start a new transaction by aborting a previous. We can't abort the transaction that we don't know the outcome of. Because in order to do that, we need to be really sure that when A1 and B1 decide to do that, that they're not going to take that back. But the coordinator could come back at any time. You know, if we decide in A1 we're going to abort this, the coordinator could come back at any time and tell machine B1, commit this. In which case, we'd end up with that half-done state we were trying to very hard to avoid. So if we had some mechanism of preventing the coordinator from coming back and doing that, maybe we could do this. But we didn't have that sort of thing here. They can't just decide that without some way of preventing the coordinator from coming back and making the transaction commit and causing that sort of conflict. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So we were looking at sort of mapping our protocols to a state machine. So sort of the state machine I had for the coordinator, we start out in this waiting for a new operation state. Then we get something to do. We send a prepare message to everyone and enter this waiting state. If we have a failure in the prepare in the waiting state, well, when we reboot, we're going to go back to the waiting state by sending a prepare message. In the waiting state, we're collecting votes. We're sending requests for votes if we need to. When we collect all the votes, we either commit or abort. And to commit or abort, not only do you go to the committed or aborted state, but we also tell the workers about the result. And in the committed or aborted state, we're doing the work of making sure we resend those results so the workers know about them if something happened. And for the worker side of things, the workers initially, they're waiting for our operation to happen. They get a request from the coordinator, and either they're going to look at that and say, yep, that's something I want to do, or no, that's something I don't want to do. If it's something they want to do, they're going to tell the coordinator that they agree to commit, and they're going to be waiting for, you know, that commit or abort message. If they tell they're not going to do it, in this diagram would just say, oh, well, they know it's going to abort anyways, so they just go right to the aborted state. And in both cases, they're going to remember what their decision was and resend it to the coordinator as needed. Some questions about the state machine here. See that. Okay, so we have our init state waiting for a prepare. Once we get a prepare, we make the decision what we do, whether we're agreeing to commit or trying to abort. We remember to resend our vote based on what state we're in. And you know, we have this commit thing where once we decide to actually know it's actually committed, we remember that we need to redo that if necessary. So why would I draw these state machine diagrams? And one reason is that sort of this is one way of picturing what goes on in the workers and the coordinator. Another reason is that it sort of maps well to what we're logging, that we can log what state we're in and know, and that's sort of exactly the information we need to log for each transaction. Another reason is that we can use this to kind of see if we handle all the cases. So for example, one thing I didn't draw on the diagram is what do we do if I got an abort message from the coordinator and I'm in the aborted state? We don't want to crash. What do we do? Well, do nothing, right? But by looking at each state, each possible message, we can make sure we aren't missing cases like that, make sure that, you know, our code doesn't crash and we handle errors. Like if I get abort in init, what do I do? Well, I just go to abort it. I apparently missed a prepare message, but we're not doing the transaction anyway, so it doesn't matter. But we want to enumerate cases like that so we don't miss some important case, like what if I get an abort message right from init, right from when I was expecting a prepare. And sort of using the state machine kind of way would let us handle that. Another advantage of this is that we specify in this sort of state machine, maybe we could like have some program like check that, oh, you know, the only way we commit things is by all workers agreeing to commit, no matter what weird reordering happens. And we might be able to sort of prove that by just exhaustively checking all the ways we can get to the committed states. Okay. So we have our upcoming assignment on two-base commit, and we're using a sort of super simplified version of this. We're going to store a single value across all workers. So the transaction operation we're doing is change the value in all the workers at once. And we're going to have a single coordinator, always the same coordinator, that's going to do it. It's only going to do one operation at a time because it doesn't make sense to have two simultaneous operations changing the same value. And we're going to be able to query the workers directly, what's the current value you have? And they'll say, here's the value, or they'll say, oh, it's being changed. If we were doing this sort of as a more direct transactional system, they'd probably say, here's the current value, or they'd wait for the transaction to finish, then give you the value, or something like that. But we're just going to say, it's being changed, ask later, in the case where it's unavailable, rather than sort of delaying our response until the transaction finishes. In the assignment, all our communication is going to be via RPC. One reason for this is that the RPC library is going to handle like failure checking. Another reason is that it makes it possible for me to make testing infrastructure to see how you handle failures, which is very annoying to do sort of standard networking stuff. In this design, the workers are only going to talk to the coordinator by replying to RPC. So the coordinator is going to make RPC calls to the workers, never the other way around. The RPC system is going to handle detecting if the worker's down, if there's network errors. And we're doing this in Python, so what's going to happen is you're going to make an RPC call, and a Python exception gets thrown in any of those errors. As we'll discuss later, you don't need to catch that exception. And because the coordinator only talks to workers by making RPC calls to them, never having the workers contact the coordinator, the coordinator needs to verify commit or abort messages are received by the workers by getting a reply. We can't have the workers proactively say, hey, coordinator, I don't know whether we're committing or aborting. The coordinator is responsible for making sure the worker gets the message, retrying if needed. And this is kind of automatic, because in this RPC system, when we make an RPC call, it has a return value. Even if it's empty, it has a return value. And so if you don't get the return value, it's going to throw an exception. So it's actually going to be very hard to tell the workers to commit without noticing and if they don't get it. In your design, something which gets people, it might be the case that your workers will never agree to abort. Maybe you'll never even have any abort operations. And that's OK, because, well, we don't really have any conflicting operations between our set to one thing, set to another thing. Operations, right? There's no conflicts where they're going to say no. We're not going to have situations where like out of disk space or anything like that. So you might really have no reason they'll just say don't do this. And your coordinator, you could choose to have it resolve any errors by just doing the transaction over again until it works. And that's fine. Like in a real system, we'd probably want the option to abort because we'd want to eventually say, oh, I'm not going to try recovering from this failure. Let's just undo everything. Just because that's simpler, or because there's some constraint where we can't do the operation. But that's not going to happen in this system. When failures occur, so in a real system, you'd probably have a bunch of logic where you say, oh, if I can't tell the workers to prepare, let's try again. And that's a very reasonable thing to do. In this assignment, we're going to handle that for you. So what we want you to do is you just return an error, and we'll restart everything and retry. So you don't worry about recovering from the failure. We're just going to restart things. We're shut down and restart the coordinator and the workers on a failure, rather than having you implement that logic. And this is just because it's much easier to test if we're doing that, rather than having you have logic which waits a second and does something. Retry. This means that when we restart the coordinator, you need to run your code, which is going to get back to a good state. So when you restart your coordinator, it's going to check its log, see where it was, and actually start do things to get back to a good state. That should be part of your coordinator's constructor. Some questions about the overall structure of the assignment? Yes? Question, do we have to have an idea about state machines? So I think you can implement this assignment without thinking about state machines, just thinking about what messages go back and forth. I think state machines are a good way to think about what information you need to log, because you want to log what step you're on, basically, and the state machine is just exactly sort of codifying that. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So one thing, some sort of notes about failures that can happen. So you mentioned that when we have network failures, like we can not send a message that we thought we sent, we cannot receive a reply to a message, and we can also have messages being delayed. So for example, let's say I have two transactions I'm doing. So I've marked them as ID 0 and ID 1. And what I might do is I might tell the worker to repair transaction ID 0, and my prepare message gets lost. So I have in the assignment, we are going to reboot the coordinator. The coordinator tells the remaining worker again. This time it works. And we commit the transaction, commit that first transaction, and we start the next transaction. That's a perfectly normal operation. So we're setting the value to one thing, then to another thing. But what might have happened is that maybe the message wasn't lost, it just was a little slow. And if we're doing these transactions right after another, it's not very unreasonable that the a little slow message will be received while we're doing the second transaction. And we need to know on worker 2 that this prepare message isn't valid. And how would we know that? So one way we can know that is we can say, gosh, I already agreed to commit this and committed it. Therefore, that's not an operation that's in progress. This must be an old message I can ignore. That's one way we can know that. I already got a commit message for this. Can't be useful information. Let's not disrupt the current operation. Another way we might know it is we can look at sort of RID 0 here and RID 1 and say, well, the way our transactions work, we know our coordinator only does one transaction at a time in the system. So I can just say if the coordinator has a transaction with ID 1, there must not be one with ID 0 that's active anymore. That's not true like sort of in a general system which does lots of transactions at once, but here we know there's only one, so we can take advantage of that and say there's a transaction with ID 1. That means that we must have finished any transaction with ID 0 because we only do one at a time and the IDs are assigned sequentially. But you need some sort of detection to handle this case to make sure you don't get confused and say, and try to do something about this old operation. So questions? This scenario. And I guess it's worth mentioning, in the assignment, we're going to give you sort of a log class. And in that log class, you can store whatever you want. So you can store past transaction IDs, you can store the last transaction ID you saw. The way that it's going to work is you're going to store a Python object, so you can put whatever you want in there. Other questions? Yeah, and in a real system, you might not. So sort of what, how you might handle with this with multiple transactions that are active, you could like keep track of, you know, a timestamp and recently committed transaction IDs, and that would be a way of resolving this sort of in a system that has lots of transactions at once going on. So let's look at, just to review things a little bit with two-phase commit, so specific examples of what might happen in some specific failure cases. So one failure case is that we prepare, we don't get a message back from the preparer. We saw this before. You know, the coordinator is going to just retry it. In the assignment, you're going to crash, and we're going to restart your coordinator. And when it restarts, you're going to make sure the other worker prepares and that it actually happens. So this is one way we could deal with, you know, failing to get a message to a worker or failing to get a reply. Another thing we could do, another option that is equally valid and perhaps simpler to implement, is that we could just decide on our, you know, reboot or after a timeout that, oh, didn't get a reply from worker 2, let's just not do it. that's still consistent, and you know, we know something failed, so that's option. And if this were like a database system, we know whatever's above us in the database system would like redo the operation anyways, so we don't need to bother doing it ourselves. So that would be another option. So questions? This idea that, you know, I just decided to abort it because I didn't get a reply, that's sort of a valid option. It might not be the most efficient option, but you know, it works and it makes my coordinator error handling code simpler, so maybe that's what I do. So another sort of scenario thing we can do is we can have that same sort of scenario happen if we don't get plugged. Now how about the case where we have, we tell a worker to commit and we don't get a reply. So what should happen there? So sort of the way things are going to work in our assignment is that, you know, we might tell the worker to commit, we don't get a reply. Maybe it's because the worker didn't get the commit message. Maybe it happens that the worker did get the commit message, but then it failed. We don't know which. Or maybe the worker did get the commit message, but then getting the reply failed. But in either case, all those cases, we're going to send the commit message again, and hopefully we're going to get our sort of yes, I got it reply the second time. And that's sort of the design we're going to have for the assignment. So questions? Okay. Or other questions about the assignment? We're going to spend some time on our next topic. Yes. So the last arrow, do you mean the arrow going down? The last arrow going down, yeah, represents the coordinator trying again in our assignment. That would be after reboot. Question, is only 2 worker 2 and not worker 1? In this diagram, it's only 2 worker 2. However, if it simplified your implementation, you could just go to worker 1. You could go to worker 1 and worker 2, and that would be fine, right? Because receiving extra commits is just going to redo the operation potentially. Not a big deal. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So, we talked about distributed computing. We're going to go back to our single machine scenario. We're going to talk about some security-related stuff. And we're going to have sort of 2 things related to preventing users from doing bad things. So 2 vocab terms here. So one is the term protection. Protection in the terms of operating systems is going to mean mechanisms that control accesses to resources. So for example, page tables define what parts of physical memory a program can access. And so it controls access to physical memory. A scheduler, or CPU scheduler, controls access to the processor. Determines how much and what when you get access to the processor. Encryption is a way of controlling access to information. So these are sort of mechanisms that control access to resource. And I want to make sure to think of that as a separate thing from what we'll think of as sort of security things. That we might want our operating systems to do. And we're going to want our operating systems to provide security where we prevent misuse of resources. We prevent you from accessing memory you're not supposed to. And sort of the way we're going to define that is that there's some sort of misuse of memory or misuse of the processor that we want to, or misuse of files that we want to prevent. You know, so we have some policy like, don't expose this information to bad people. And we're going to implement that policy using these protection mechanisms. So in this class, we're going to mostly be talking about mechanisms. We're not going to talk a lot about the policies. There's, of course, a lot of interesting questions. Like, how do I set these policies? And so on. What we're going to try to do is we're going to try to create mechanisms that can be configured to support a lot of policies. But we're not going to be so concerned about what's the right policy and how does that work. Now, I talked about protection here. I said, like, page tables, they control access to physical memory. But there's something about sort of the security problem where we can't think of page tables in the same way we've often been thinking about them so far. So usually when we thought about page tables, we're saying, you know, they're meant to prevent your program from accidentally, like, stepping over whatever the kernel's doing. They're, you know, going to make sure if you, like, have an error, like you go beyond the end of the stack, that things crash. Things like that. They're meant to help you save memory. But in the security world, we're going to be worried about adversaries. We're going to be worried about not sort of what typically happens. We're going to be worried about people who study how our system works and do the worst possible thing to get around our protection mechanism. So that means that it's not going to be good enough to think about what typically happens. Think about whether, say, our CPU scheduling algorithm like divides up the processor time in a nice way in typical scenarios. We need to think about what happens if someone's trying to exploit the system, who knows how it works, knows all the details. What can they do? That's a very different problem. It's going to require sort of different types of solutions. Even though it may happen that they're sharing things with the sort of solutions we use for that not adversarial problem where people weren't doing the worst possible thing like the other things we saw us doing with page tables or CPU scheduling. Okay. So for many of these policies we're going to have, we're going to want to prevent adversaries from doing things that non-adversary people we trust can do. We're going to want to identify programs running on behalf of some individual or organization and let them do things that we don't let programs that aren't running on behalf of some organization or individual do. In order to have a policy like that, we need to have some notion of who is who. And the process of figuring out who is who for our system, we're going to call that authentication. And we're going to think of like entering a password that's meant to serve the purpose of identifying who's using the system. Separately from that, we're going to talk about the problem of authorization. Once we know who is who, how do we use that information to decide who what they can do? Okay. So we have these two problems, authentication, figuring out who is who, and once we know that, who's responsible for a program, how do we figure out what they can do? So talk a bit about authentication. We have like passwords. You can have other mechanisms like hardware tokens you plug into a machine or SMS messages, all sorts of ways of authenticating. In this class, we're not going to be concerned with how, but we are going to be concerned with once we've authenticated, how do we keep track of that authentication information? Because we're going to want to know, you know, once that this program has been identified as being run by this person versus someone else. So that's what we're going to look like. Okay. So we have authentication. We'll go back to what authentication looks like and how we track this a little more later. And then we have to do authorization with this. And sort of a very abstract way we can represent sort of the authorization problem is that we have a bunch of what we'll call protection domains. And typically these represent people. They could also represent like organizations, groups of people, and so on. We have a bunch of protection domains, like representing a particular user or like faculty or something, and we'll assign each process to one or more of these. And based on what protection domain you're in, that's going to define what operations you're allowed to do with every single object, like file, process, anything managed by the operating system on the system. And we'll just have this giant matrix of all the operations you're allowed to do for every object based on which protection domains your process is in. And this is sort of an abstract view of how we might think of their permissions. And we'll talk about sort of two ways of representing this information in this table later, one of which is way more common. So I mentioned we're going to assign each process to one or more protection domains, and typically these are going to map to like a particular person or something like that. So how does that work? And we're going to talk about how this works on sort of traditional Unix. And the most common way OSs do it, Unix and others, is we have some sort of user ID. So we have some procedure, probably something involving a password, that sets a user ID. And then every process has a user ID that's stored with the process control block. And this user ID is used to decide what the process is authorized to do most of the time. So in POSIX, there are user IDs. So there's a library called getEUID, which returns the effective user ID, which is a number. So in the sort of Unix design, the kernel only deals with user ID numbers. Right? Say, but I have a username. That stuff is entirely managed in libraries. The kernel only knows about numbers, and it stores this number with the process. So we have some calls to get it. And our standard library is going to have this mapping from names to numbers for like displaying them, and so on. So this user ID, primary way of identifying who a process is running on behalf of. POSIX also supports group IDs. So example groups, you know, might be like, we might have a group for faculty, a group for students. And in POSIX, a process has an effective group ID and also a list of extra group IDs. And just like with the user IDs, the kernel only knows about numbers. These numbers map to names, but that's done outside of the kernel. That's just done in the libraries. And you might notice here that we have the effective user ID and the effective group ID. You might say, wait a moment, does that mean there's other user and group IDs? Yes, and we'll probably talk about those briefly next time, why there would be other IDs associated with the process. But the effective one is the one that we're actually going to use to figure out, can you open a file, can you kill a process, that sort of thing. So if I log into a department machine and run the command ID, it happens to print out my user and group IDs. So you see here, I ran on the department machine power 4. It printed out that my user ID was 858182. And also, I had the effective group ID of 21, and also 325 and 90027. And this program also looked up the names that correspond to those user and group IDs. So the name corresponding to my user ID is my computing ID. The name corresponding to those group IDs was CS faculty, instructors, and 4414. And from this, it might seem like, gosh, these group IDs, they're just redundant with the username, user ID, right? I could figure out what groups I should be in from the user ID. Why do we bother having the group IDs? That part of the theory of the groups is that the group ID doesn't need to correspond to what user it is. So for example, we could make a video group that has access to the monitor. And we could decide that when you run a process by physically walking up to a machine and logging in, your process is in the video group. If you SSH in, it's not. And this idea would mean that, you know, you would only have access to the monitor when you physically walked up to the machine, otherwise you wouldn't. And this is a very nice idea, part of the sort of motivation for having the groups be very independent of the users' IDs. As a security mechanism, it's maybe not so great against adversaries. So one issue is that if I log into the machine physically, I can run a program, keep it running in the background, log out, and that program's still in the video group. That's maybe less than ideal. That's tricky to deal with. Maybe this is not a super effective mechanism, but that sort of was the idea behind it. So questions about users and groups so far? Okay, so we know about our protection domains, but we have the other part of this table, which is, given we have a protection domain, how do I look up for a particular file or process? What operations it's allowed to do. And there's kind of two strategies for representing this giant matrix of operations. So one strategy is we kind of represent the columns, the files or so on. We have a list with them called an access control list what users, groups, etc. are allowed to use the item, and in what ways. An alternate strategy is we can just have a bunch of domain, object, and permissions pairs stored like in some separate database. And both of these are in actual use in the real world. So the first mechanism is by far the most common way we specify what you could do with objects. The second, AppArmor as an example, has like a global configuration file where you can like restrict what programmers can do to what, sort of separately from the actual files that you're trying to restrict. But in either case, we're going to need to look up, you know, the list that corresponds to our particular object and domain. So I'm going to talk about these access control lists. And POSIX, confusingly, defines sort of two types of access control lists. So there's one, which is implemented on every Unix system, and there's another, which POSIX specifies, that is actually relatively rare to see implemented, even though it's been specified by POSIX. So the one that's implemented by every POSIX system is an access control list, but it's extremely restricted. So like, when I told to find an access control list, I said, oh, we have a list of protection domains and permissions and things you can do. The list that sort of all Unix systems support, well, it's a list, but it's a very limited list. It stores one user ID. What more user ID is too bad? You only get one. And that user ID has a read, write, or execute bit, which can be all set, all not set. Plus, as a special case, that user ID is called the owner and is the only one who has the permission to change these permissions. It stores one group ID. You want more than one group ID? Too bad. And whether people, whether processes in that group ID can read, write, or execute, it has a default if you don't match the user or group, whether you can read, write, or execute. And this is stored for every file and directory. This sort of very, very limited access control list. So we get to specify one user ID in our list, one group ID in our list, and for the user and group, can you read or write or execute or some combination. And if you use the chmod command, this is what the chmod command manipulates the read, write, or execute part. And separately, there's ways of setting the group and user IDs. Questions about these sort of very, very limited access control list here. So as I said, this is a very limited, and one way it's limited is like if I want to allow two specific people to access a file, it's actually really awkward with this system. I need to like have them both be in the same group, because that means I have to create a group for every pair of people I want to access a file, and set make the file be part of that group and have that group ID and set that permission. That's doable, but very tricky. So POSIX specifies, and a few systems actually implement, and also Windows have more flexible access control lists, where it looks more like that idea I started you with, that it's really a list of lots of users and groups. So in POSIX, you can specify these access control lists, and this would be for a particular file or directory with a sort of the file that looks like this. So in this example, I say everyone in the students group can read or execute. Everyone in the faculty group can read, write, or execute. User MST3K, regardless of what other groups they're in, can read, write, or execute. User TJ1A, regardless of whatever groups they're in, can do neither of those things. And I could specify, you know, as many users and groups as I want, essentially. Like, obviously, there's going to be some size limit because we're running out of space, but effectively, as many as I want. Some questions about this sort of idea of an access control list. And so I'd specify this for every file, every directory I want to control access to. Okay, so we've talked about sort of specifying, you know, what protection domain you're in, specifying, given a protection domain, what things can be accessed in what ways. But how do we actually enforce these checks? And the sort of mechanism that a traditional Unix design uses is that on system call entry, we're going to check these access control lists or other ways we're representing the access control matrix. So for example, when you open a file, or when you rename a file in a directory, we're going to check the permissions for that file or directory. When you kill a process, we're going to make sure you're allowed to kill this process. And just sort of all the system calls are going to be responsible for doing these authorization checks when you make the system call. And it's going to be important that it's done in the system call, because that's code that the kernel controls that no adversary should be able to change. So questions about authorization checking. So let's do a little about authorization. So let's say, so here are a bunch of ideas for doing things that might be more performant or better. And the question is, which of these would still be secure to do? So A is, the way we traditionally do, like, get the current user ID or get the current process ID is that we make, have a, if you look at what XV6 does, is you make a system call, and the only thing the system call does is read a value and return it to you. So what we could do instead is let you access the memory where that value is stored just by making its page table entry be marked as readable by you, but not writable. Question, is that going to be okay for accessing your user ID? B is, could we, you know, instead of just performing the authorization checks in the standard library, sorry, the system call handlers, could we also do them in the standard library so we don't make system calls that are going to fail anyways? For C, could we just perform them in the standard library instead, because that lets us, you know, might be a more convenient place to do it? And D, could we make the system user ID be an argument to the system call rather than having us have to retrieve it every time from the process control block? Give a little time to think. Okay, so who would like more time? Okay, so who thinks A would still be secure? Okay, who thinks A would not still be secure? Okay, so for A, I think the answer is yes, if nothing sensitive on that, nothing sensitive elsewhere on that page. That's kind of an if, because like if we think of XV6, like your process control block is on the same page as other process control blocks, and you shouldn't be able to read the other process's data. But if we don't have that problem, it's fine. If we do have that problem, we need to be more careful, but we could resolve it by like moving, making sure we store your process's stuff on a separate page from any other process. And this sort of strategy is actually used in Linux, for example. So Linux, for example, there's a way of getting the current time. That used to be a system call. And what they've done in some recent versions is they put a lot of the time information just in a separate page, made that page readable by all processes to avoid making a system call. Okay, how about B? Thinks that would still be secure? Okay, who thinks that would not still be secure? Okay, so yes, it would still be secure, but it's a bad idea. So why do I say it's a bad idea? Well, you're just doing, usually the check is going to not be bad. Usually it's going to pass anyways. And you still need to do the extra check for security. And if we think of like opening a file, like the permissions in the file could change in between when we do the check in the center library and when we do the check in the kernel. Way to avoid that. How about C? Who thinks that's still secure? Think that's not still secure? So that's not still secure. So how could you take advantage of a system that works this way? Someone wanna tell me? Like what would an adversary do if we just did the checks in the standard library? Not the system quite number. Yes. Yes. So they you could yes. So the adversary can call the system call. Adversary makes their own system call wrapper. That's the easiest way to take advantage of this. I don't need to use the one in the standard library, I can just call me. Okay, how about D? Who thinks D is still secure? Not still secure? Okay. So this would be indeed no, because the program can change the user ID, you know, possibly with a new system call wrapper. So questions on these examples? So we've talked about doing authorization checks and storing our information on what you're authorized to do. And we mentioned sort of the idea of authentication. But one kind of problem we had is like sort of how we, you know, bootstrap this whole thing, right? How do we handle like logging in and things like that? Where does the authentication actually happen? And to do that, we're going to have one special user ID. So on Unix, user ID 0 is special. This is commonly called super user or root, but remember the kernel only knows the number it knows is 0, and it's special in two ways. So one way is that there's some system calls, like the system call to shut down the machine. That's only gonna work for user ID 0. So there's just a check, if your user ID is 0, we let you do this, otherwise we don't. Also, most permissions checks, there's just a special case for user ID 0 where we just say, yes, you have permission to do that. So we're just going to ignore the access control list and say, yes, you have permission to read this file, for example, for user ID 0. And that's just a special case in the system calls for this user ID. Okay, so we have this special user ID. And let's now think about logging. So when we step up to a machine, we can log in as a user, and this login program, we enter, say, our username and our password, and this program somehow is checking if the password is correct, changing to that user ID, and then running a shell. This is some program that's running. This is not generally on a Unix system done by the kernel. This is just a normal program. Right? So how can the normal program do that? So part of it is that this program is going to run as that super user user. So it's going to bypass most of the permission checks, not because they aren't there, but because they have a special case for user ID 0. And one thing it needs to do is check if the password is correct. So what does it do? Well, it gets the password from its input, and then it needs to somehow read what the real password is to compare somehow. And the conventional way this is done on Unix is that on a single user system, there's just a special file, most commonly called etc/shadow, which is marked with an access control list as only readable by root, user ID 0. So that's a common way. And in this way, the kernel's not really involved in actually checking the password. The kernel just says, oh, are you user ID 0? Then you can access this file. Otherwise, you can't. And that way, we restrict what programs can check passwords. On a department machine, the department has a bunch of machines, they all share the same passwords. How does that work? Well, they typically have a network service. So rather than looking up in a file, the login program knows to contact a particular machine on the network, that they're using some cryptography. We make sure that we're actually communicating with that machine, and that machine validates the password for us and says, yes, this is really that user ID's password. And using that information, it can verify that, yes, that password is correct. But notice that, like, we have these two different approaches. None of these actually involve the kernel doing anything special. It's just, for as far as the kernel is concerned, this login program is just a normal program that happens to run early. It happens to run as a user ID with lots of access to things. And this also means that we could easily replace that authentication mechanism of using a password with checking some token I plug into the machine, checking biometrics, sending an SMS. It's all things that, you know, as far as the kernel is concerned, it's not a change we have to make to the kernel. It's just the program is just doing something different before it runs the check. So questions about our authentication? Okay, now once we actually validate our password, we want to make sure that we actually run as the user you logged in as. We can't keep running as user ID 0, because, well, you're not supposed to be able to read the password database, for example. So we need to change user IDs. How do we do that? I mentioned the user ID is stored as part of the program, so we need some help from the kernel to do this. So we're part of the process control block. It shouldn't be changed by the user or user. And POSIX has a call called setUID, which, if you're a super user, sets your effective user ID to whatever value is passed in. Now, if you're not super user, you can still call this call, but it's very, very limited in what it will let you do. But as super user, you can change your user ID to whatever you want. So the login program, you know, starts as super user when it on system boot, but then it makes a call to the setUID function and thereby gives up its access to the special user ID 0 stuff. And once it calls that, you know, now it's just writing with the access of a normal user. No longer does it have the, all the special cases where it can read any file and so on. So questions about setUID and sort of the general login process. Okay, so we saw that on boot, well, we have something running as a special user ID which has sort of full access. We give that user ID access to the authentication stuff. But as far as the kernel is concerned, you know, the only thing special is that I have a case in my can you open this file checks and things like that that allow that program, because of its user ID, to do things that other programs can't. Other than that, it's not actually a special program. Now, we have something else you may have done on the machines. So if you've used the sudo command, for example, so you might learn, oh, sudo, that's how you access system administrator stuff. So we're running as a normal user, in this case, apparently 2J1A. I run a command that I can't do as a normal user, restart, and I do it with this sudo program, and I type my password in, and the sudo program runs that with extra permissions. In fact, it runs it as user ID 0. And it checks for a password because we're not supposed to let just anyone do that. So the question is, how does this sudo program work? We can't just call setUID to 0, because if we just let any program do that at any time, there would be no point in having you have a separate user ID, because you'd rather just, you could do more by having user ID 0. So we want to restrict that somehow. And also, this sudo program needs to access that password database. And we mentioned on a single user machine, that's a file only user ID 0 can read. So it needs to run code as user ID 0 to access that password database. So how does that happen? So what's the mechanism that's going to let us write a program like sudo that does this? And the way that Unix, your sort of POSIX, chose to do this is that they have this metadata bit attached to executables called the setUserID bit. And the exec call has a special case that if the setUserID bit is set when we execute a program, before we start that program's main function, we're going to change the effective userID of the current process to the owner of that executable. So the sudo program is owned by root user ID 0, and it's marked set user ID. So when we exec sudo, before sudo's main starts, the effective user ID of our process becomes 0. And that means sudo can access the password database, it can set UID to 0 or whatever user ID it wants, and can run those programs with that user ID 0 permission. And the sudo program is responsible for doing whatever it wants to do with these permissions. So in the case of sudo, it doesn't just run whatever you want as user ID 0. It has some policy where it decides, oh, I'm going to only let certain users do this, and I'm going to check a password. So it checks that password, and we can't bypass that password check because, well, execs runs things as user ID 0, but it only runs sudo starting at the beginning of main. And sudo starting at the beginning of main, well, it's going to check password. So questions about this set user ID idea? And I'm showing you set user ID sort of using something owned by root, so we have UID 0. It also applies to other user IDs. So we can also set user ID to some ordinary user. It's just whoever owns the executable. And we can think of set user ID as kind of a way we can give controlled access to functionality without modifying the kernel. So normally, we think of it as, oh, if I want you to be able to do an operation, you know, as a particular user, I need the kernel to have a system call that like does that. Like, if I want you to be able to restart the machine, there needs to be like a system call to do the restart, and the kernel needs to know who can do that. And what set user ID stuff allows us to do is we can write a program to do anything that root can do, and we can allow any user to do it, and we can also enforce whatever restrictions we like on that operation. So I can say, I'm going to allow you to restart, but only after 5 p.m. We can enforce that in our program, because we can like check the time before we run the restart command. And so, sort of as a general idea, this sort of mechanism of set user ID programs lets us sort of add sort of what we might think of as sort of new system calls that normal users can run when the kernel's sort of hard-coded code says, oh, this is only allowed for special users, for usually super user. And the program can have whatever checks we want to ensure that's only done in a case that's okay with us. So this is a nice, very flexible mechanism that sort of lets us add functionality to our access control system that we couldn't really express with the access control list and the like we had. So like, we didn't have like a file whose access control list we could set to control whether you could reboot the machine, but we can make a program that does that for us and set the access controls on that program however we like. And we can mark that program as set user ID so the system allows it to run with the permissions needed to reboot, even though we can't directly set an access control list for rebooting. So this lets us sort of add that operation. And on a common Unix system, there are actually lots of set user ID programs that exist out there for doing sort of common operations. So for example, if you have like a Linux laptop and you or even a Mac laptop and you plug in a USB stick, mounting a file system, making those files visible, typically requires a system call that's restricted to user ID 0. But commonly we'll have some set user ID program that you can run that will do that system call for you, but it's going to do it carefully. It's going to check to make sure, oh, are you mounting this in a place where it's not going to overwrite anything sensitive, hide anything sensitive that we shouldn't have changed? It's only going to you're only going to like put the USB sticks files in a directory that you control. Are we going to make sure that you can't make a new set user ID root program by mounting a USB stick? We can do that in this extra program, even though sort of the raw system call that it's calling doesn't enforce that. but it can enforce extra restrictions like what you mount, where you can mount it, that you don't like mount the normal hard disk this way, that has to be done differently, and so on. We can use a set user ID program to like let you access a device, like the monitor or a printer. So we might not want any program to just have direct access to a printer, or we could have a program which we know is going to actually just print things and not mess up the printer. Or we could have a program which displays things, but it checks to make sure that no one else is using the display first. We can make that program set user ID, but not let anyone just directly access the display. We wanted to say, write to a log file. We could have a program that like appends to a log, but doesn't like let you remove things from the log. And that's something we can't do by just setting the log as write-only, because if it's write-only, you can overwrite it. But if we have a program that just depends, you know, that's all it does. So questions on sort of uses for set user ID programs? And I guess sort of as a general analogy, I consider set user ID programs are kind of like, you know, kind of analogous to system calls. So system calls are like accessing functionality that only the hardware only allows the kernel to access. And set user ID programs are for accessing functionality that the kernel only allows user ID 0 or similar to access. And in a controlled way. So with system calls, like we don't give you full access to what the hardware can do. We give you access to some useful set of functionality that's safe. Same idea with a set user ID program, hopefully. Questions on this? So in the interest of being even with the other section where there were a lot more questions, probably stop roughly here, but the topic I'll have for next time is why you shouldn't write a set user ID program. So it turns out that it is extremely difficult to write, to have a set user ID program and make it secure. It's surprisingly hard. Like, yes, this is how sudo works, but I do not recommend trying to write programs like that because it is supremely error-prone. You are very likely to create, you know, not a program that lets users do one particular thing, but a program that lets users do absolutely anything as user ID 0, even though that's not what you're intending. But that's where I'll leave off for today. We'll catch up, finish on that topic on Thursday.